From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, Ford slashes its car offerings.
Look, Ford is basically saying that they think trucks and SUVs are going to be 90% of their sales volume in the United States by the turn of the decade.
Underpaid, overworked public defenders with zero support staff. A new report finds if you can't afford an attorney in Wayne County, your options are not what the framers of the Constitution had in mind.
It was among the most efficient systems I've ever seen in my 20-year career.
We've done a lot of studying already. I think it's time to take action and do something very positive.
MSU students take a class exploring money in Michigan politics.
So that was surprising to me to see how much power and influence the DeVos family has here in Michigan.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Hello, and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. In 1908, Henry Ford sent the first Model T rolling off the assembly line at his Piquette Avenue plant in Detroit. 110 years later, the Ford Motor Company signals it is no longer betting on cars for its future. Michigan Radio's Tracy Samilton is here now. So, Tracy, what has Ford announced?
Well, they're going to have two sedans on the market very, very soon. They're going to have the Mustang. You can't get rid of the Mustang. It's part of their DNA. And they're going to have a small crossover. One assumes it's going to be small in the Focus line.
And
that's it. So for small cars. That's it.
So tell us, what's headed the way of the Model T?
Gone, the Fiesta subcompact, the Focus sedan, the C-Max hybrid crossover, the Fusion midsize sedan, and the Taurus large sedan. They're all on the chopping block.
Wow. And so why is this? What do the numbers tell us?
Well, the numbers tell us that Ford is just not keeping up in terms of the ability to make profit on small cars. You have to have volume. They're less profitable, so you need the volume. And Ford cannot keep up with Toyota and Honda. In March, Toyota and Honda, their small and midsize cars, they were selling in the 30,000 number. Ford was half that last month. So they just can't keep up. It's not making money for them.
So, and Ford's going to be adding five new SUVs over the next 2 years. And then that 2019 Ranger midsize pickup that we all saw at the Detroit Auto Show in January. So what's going to be the bottom line when all of these moves are made over the next couple of years?
Ford is going to be a truck and crossover and SUV company. There's no question. And it is where the market is going. 60% of the market right now is crossovers and SUVs.
We were stopped at a light the other day in heavy traffic. And my husband and I looked around and I went, look at this. It's all pickups, SUVs, and crossovers. And then one little car came up finally, totally outnumbered.
And you know those parking lots where it says small car only? You have to park there if you have a crossover. There are no small cars left.
And there's going to be some major belt tightening. Last fall, Ford announced it's cutting spending by, what, $14 billion, and now it's going to carve another $11.5 billion in cost in the next few years. Where are these reductions going to come from?
Well, this is part of what they're doing here. They're eliminating entire programs. They're eliminating the need for the platforms that you might use for a small car. They're moving from 9 platforms to 5. So all their vehicles will go on these 5 platforms throughout the world, and it will save money.
Michigan Radio's Tracy Samilton. Thanks so much, Tracy.
Happy to be here.
Let's turn now to Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes. Daniel, did Ford surprise you with this announcement?
No, not at all. I mean, they have been, so to those of us who've been reporting this out for months, we saw this coming. I wrote a couple columns in the news earlier in the year saying that this was part of a two-part strategy. The first part was going to be the big product show that they did in Dearborn about a month ago, and the second part was going to be their first quarter earnings announcement where they were going to start to put some meat on the bones. I think there's more to come. In the deck that they posted online, they even say there's more to come, and it's going to culminate in an investors meeting in late September where they're presumably going to talk in a little bit more detail about what they're going to be doing, potentially exiting markets. They've already announced a lot of pairing to their product line, so I don't necessarily expect it to be on the product side, but it could be in other parts of the business.
So Ford's keeping the Mustang and the Focus active crossover. Are those the right cars to keep building?
given the trends in the U.S. market, I think you could make the argument that they are, but I think people need to be careful here about drawing too many conclusions about cutting cars and making more SUVs. We're not talking about necessarily just eliminating all cars. We're talking about some of those vehicles being reborn with the same architectures underneath them, by the way, the same engines, the same suspensions, the same, all of the bits and bobs underneath, but with different, what they call in the industry, hats. So they may look, it may have a little higher ride height, which is what this Focus Active, which has been introduced, by the way, in Europe, is. It's basically a Focus that's got a higher ride height. It's all-wheel drive. It looks a little more crossover-ish, but it's essentially still a car. And a lot of the crossovers and SUVs that the industry is producing are delivering some of the same kind of fuel efficiency that you can get in cars. The engines are a lot smaller than they used to be. The displacements are smaller and the mileage is better.
Now, these five new SUVs that will be coming that nobody has seen yet, that Ford will be unveiling, is that what you see? This kind of, it's a car, but just packaged a little differently?
No, okay. Not necessarily. I mean, a Bronco or a Ranger, a lot of your listeners are fondly remember the Ranger. Ford decided to get rid of it and to bet everything on variations of its F-Series F-150 pickup. General Motors went in a different direction, had a smaller Colorado and Canyon with GMC and Chevrolet to match their Sierra and Silverado full-size pickups. So GM's been on a two-truck strategy. Ford hasn't. They're coming back to that. So I think that is more of a traditional truck. I think the Bronco will be more of a traditional truck. But look, Ford is basically saying that they think trucks and SUVs are going to be 90% of their sales volume in the United States by the turn of the decade.
It begs the question, what happens when gas spikes up to $4 or $5 a gallon? In fact, it's already around $4 a gallon in L.A.
Right. So that's a great question. And I would go back to one of the points I made earlier. One is there's still going to be vehicles in the portfolio that deliver really good gas mileage. They're going to be smaller, and they're going to have smaller engines. Two, dig a little deeper into what Ford is doing. They're also offering hybrid, gas-electric hybrid options of virtually everything in their fleet. So the trucks, SUVs, big, small, medium, all would come with those kind of powertrains, which will deliver better fuel economy and what is expected to be the same price. And historically, those powertrains have cost the consumer more money. It has been essentially a premium option. What I think the manufacturers are trying to get to is a point where it's not a premium option, it's just an option. And you will be able to get better fuel economy with a gas electric hybrid. And the bigger the vehicle is, think about it this way, the bigger the vehicle is and the more of them they sell, the more fuel is saved.
Hey, I want to turn your attention to the newly announced first quarter earning reports from our U.S. car makers. What do they tell you?
Well, it's kind of, I hate this, a cliche, but it's a bit of a tale of two car companies or three car companies. You know, in the case of Fiat Chrysler, Jeep is driving earnings to record levels. Again, we're talking about the popularity of SUVs in the American market. General Motors is clicking on all cylinders. Some of their numbers dropped a little bit from the same time last year. That was in part because of some of the stuff they were doing, have been doing, launching their pickups. But I don't think anybody's missing a beat with General Motors. They are truly moving on all cylinders. Ford, I think we're getting yet another reminder of why they replaced their CEO last year, about a year ago, next month. And that is that they were falling further behind. They were not planning properly for the future, and they were not making hard calls about their product lineup and what they should be building and selling and what they shouldn't be building and selling. And how should they change some of that? And now you're seeing them go through that process. It's very frustrating for investors. It's frustrating for the media. People want answers yesterday, and they're not necessarily getting them. Ford's trying to move ahead and give people more information, but I don't think they want to get too far out over their proverbial skis here. So you really see three companies that are all making money. Don't misunderstand, but Ford clearly is trying to fix its core business. And you get a sense with General Motors, the core business is humming. With some exceptions. They just made a change at Cadillac because they don't feel that the leadership at Cadillac was focused enough on gaining business in the United States. A lot of it was coming from China. And that's the other piece of this whole thing is China, China, China. China is so important to this industry going forward. It's driving a lot of decision-making at luxury brand level and also with electric vehicle strategies. Most of General Motors' EVs that they're going to be introducing I think 20 by 2023, most of them will be sold in China.
And as you point out in your column today, the auto show in Beijing is going to showcase 174 electric vehicles and 124 of those engineered and produced in China.
The Chinese are coming. They are buying. Look, the Chinese bought Volvo. I mean, how do you get into the game? There's two ways. You kind of take the Japanese approach and build a brand, be very patient. That's what we've seen over 30, 40, 50 years, right? There's the Chinese approach, which is you can buy your way in, and one of the ways you buy your way in is to buy an established brand like Volvo. And then they shocked corporate Germany when they revealed that they own almost 10% of Daimler, which is the parent of Mercedes-Benz. So they are on the move, and I think they also are using their partnerships that they've had with General Motors and Ford and Volkswagen in China to get really smart, really fast, and then be able to leverage that knowledge and spread it across the entire industry in China. When one of the things they want to do is they want to get out of the country. They want to build electric vehicle capability in China, but they also want to get out of the country and are looking for ways into Europe and also the United States.
And of course, we see China's entry in the U.S. market would be an SUV from Great Wall in 2021.
Well, GAC, right.
Yeah.
That's exactly right. Although I just saw a report this morning that suggested that they are concerned about a brewing trade war between China and the U.S. might complicate their ability to come into the U.S., which I would say is probably a pretty fair bet.
Detroit News business columnist Daniel House. Thanks so much, Daniel.
Sure, thank you.
Coming up, a group of MSU students has just wrapped up a class that looks at the money in state politics, and their eyes were opened.
In a non-election year, state legislators had to raise more than $55,000 on average.
People can make a more informed decision on who they're going to vote for if they pay attention to things like campaign finances.
That's in 10 minutes here on Stateside from Michigan Radio. You are listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It has been more than 2 years since a young Muslim Marine recruit from Taylor died in a fall at a boot camp on Paris Island, reportedly after being abused, hazed, and slapped by his drill instructor. Today, the family of Raheel Siddiqui is scheduled to be in a federal courtroom in Detroit for a motion hearing on a $100 million lawsuit they filed against the U.S. Marine Corps. And the family now believes medical records they've obtained have raised more questions and more doubts about the official version of their son's death. Todd Spangler of the Detroit Free Press is here now. Todd, the family finally got medical records from the Medical University of South Carolina, where Raheel was taken and died in March 2016. Broadly speaking, what are the questions they now have?
Well, the records that the family has received seem to indicate the treatment that he received after he fell, but his family is really raising questions about whether these records are accurate or not. Having seen some of these, but not all of these records, they're pointing at inconsistencies in the records, items that don't seem to make sense given, you know, his age, his health, what happened to him, what reportedly happened to him. And they're asking more questions about it, thinking that they haven't really gotten the whole story yet.
Well, it was interesting as I read your story from this week in the Detroit Free Press, there's even different times of death.
Right. One of the major things they've been asking questions about, actually for a very long time, is that where his death certificate says that he died at 5:45 a.m., that's actually the time of the fall that apparently killed him at Paris Island, South Carolina, 5:45 a.m., March 18th, 2016. But the autopsy report, which was done by a medical examiner at the Medical University of South Carolina in Charleston, actually has two different times of death. One says 10:06 a.m., one says 10:45 a.m. that same day after he was apparently transported there for more treatment.
Yeah, there are certainly many questions, and even there was a nurse's note that Siddiqui denied more than an hour after his fall being subjected to threats or abuse.
Yeah, this was one of the ones that really does beg a lot of questions, where some of these records, you know, who knows, the hospitals aren't talking, the lawyers aren't talking about this, about what they might or might not mean. But this one is actually a very interesting one. So there's a nurse's report that says that sometime shortly after 7 a.m. that day, that he denied being abused or being hit by anyone. But other records that are in that same pack of medical records suggest that when he was brought into the hospital at 6:30 that morning and shortly thereafter, that he was unresponsive, that there was not any way for him to actually affirmatively deny that anything happened.
There was something else you wrote about, that there was one form regarding a medication order that the family feels suggested the patient was pregnant or breastfeeding.
Right. So, and this is one of those ones where it would really be helpful if someone from the hospital would have been able to sort of, you know, talk us through this. Yeah, there's a record. It's a medication record that says on it, currently breastfeeding, currently pregnant. Now, what's hard to tell, I mean, clearly Rahil Siddiqui was neither of those things when this happened. And what were these things that someone who is taking care of medicine in an emergency situation is supposed to circle on a form to tell a doctor, oh, don't prescribe this because the patient is breastfeeding or pregnant? It's kind of hard to tell. But the family looks at that and says, hey, this isn't our son. What is this record? What does this mean? And they don't think they've gotten all the answers.
What do these questions fuel for the family?
Well, overall, from talking to the lawyer for the family, Shiraz Khan, who talks on their behalf, their concern is that, major concern is that they do not believe it is correct that Rahil committed suicide. That was the official finding, the autopsy by the coroner, by the Marine Corps. They don't think that's the truth. They don't know what exactly happened, and they believe there's enough inconsistency and error and missing records, frankly, in what they've received to question how a coroner or anyone else could have come to that conclusion ultimately. They say that they haven't gotten enough evidence that they think there's any reason to back that up, and they're pressing to have it changed.
And on top of this $100 million lawsuit against the Marines, you report the family's considering more suits. Against whom and to what purpose?
Well, so that gets into this idea of getting that death certificate changed. They are considering suing the local coroner in South Carolina, the two hospitals where Rahil was reportedly treated, the paramedics who transported him, and a helicopter company that transported him from one hospital to the other, saying that these records, in their way, to their way of thinking, are not or do not seem to be accurate or do not seem to tell the whole story. Now, the family has not been entirely clear about what they want to charge each of these parties with if they even decide to go forward. As much as anything else, I think they're trying to get more information out of those parties to determine exactly what happened. But it is true that they're looking at another lawsuit. At the same time, they are trying to fight this rather uphill lawsuit against the Marine Corps for negligence.
So it is very much you can hear the anguish when you talk to the family. There's no doubt about that. And 2 years later, they still have doubts.
Absolutely.
Todd Spangler, Detroit Free Press, thank you so much.
Thank you.
The subject of campaign finance isn't something many voters spend much time thinking about. But a group of MSU students just wrapped up a class that had them diving into the money in state politics, and it was eye-opening. Eli Pales and Ian Hawley are with us now from Michigan State University, journalism students who worked on the Capital Expenditure Project. Great to have you both with us.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks for letting us be here.
Eli, I'm going to start with you. How eye-opening was this class for you?
It was incredibly interesting to delve into all these campaign finance reports. You know, a lot of the specific tidbits that we found out in terms of the demographic breakdowns, parties, stuff like that, was, I think, some of the truly surprising things that we found. And then in terms of the total amount raised for the legislators, that was really the mind-blowing element. It wasn't just the amount from PACs, but the fact that in a non-election year, state legislators had to raise more than $55,000 on average, that was kind of mind-blowing for us because, you know, most people don't even know their state legislator. And next thing you know, they're raising almost $60,000.
Ian, what was particularly gripping for you?
So my report focused on the people who raised the least amount of money.
And I tried to focus specifically on the PAC side of things as opposed to individual contributions. So the thing that was the most interesting to me was the amount of people who have been elected and haven't taken any PAC funds for their campaign. Specifically, I talked to a man named Aaron Miller, who's a House of Representatives member here in the state of Michigan. And he told me that after his first primary, which he lost in, he made the decision not to take PAC money anymore. And he's now in his third term as a representative for the state of Michigan. So it seems like there are other ways to be successfully elected rather than, you know, just quote unquote selling out and taking the PAC money.
Now, let's roll back to before you took this class and before you became involved with the Capital Expenditure Project. Eli, how much about campaign finance did you know?
I'm a little bit of a nerd. I think that Ian might agree. So I was kind of probably be the one that was actually like looking at this sort of stuff ahead of time. You know, I was really inspired by some of the things done during the 2016 campaign to raise awareness for having clean elections, campaign finance reform, that sort of thing. So this is actually a topic that I've been paying attention to for a little while.
How about you, Ian?
I hadn't really paid attention to campaign finance in Michigan. I'm originally from Alabama, so as an out-of-state student, I was paying attention to Alabama politics a little bit more closely before this. So it was really eye-opening for me to see the amount of money in Michigan politics, as well as some of the larger PACs that donate across the board to multiple candidates. That was a pretty interesting highlight for me.
Well, as the visitor from Alabama, let me ask you, Ian, more broadly, what about our campaign finance laws in Michigan? Did you find the most surprising?
I would say, so there are leadership funds, I guess is what they call them. And it's really just another name for a PAC. But there are a lot of big leadership funds here in Michigan for, you know, I believe the DeVos family is one of the largest, like, groups here in Michigan, and the DeVos PAC is a pretty big one. So that was surprising to me to see how much power and influence the DeVos family has here in Michigan.
And Eli, you say you're a self-described nerd who's been into this. So I don't know, did you find anything that surprised you, or did it kind of confirm what you had dug into and discovered?
Well, a lot of what I looked at was more on the federal level, I guess. So, you know, I knew that these congressional candidates, for example, would have to raise millions of dollars in competitive races. But I was still very blown away by how much money was raised here at the state level by individual state legislators. Because, as I said, you know, most people don't know their state legislators, but, you know, there's a lot of money behind them. And we complain a lot that there's so much money in politics, but a lot of people, I think, aren't taking necessarily the time to really do the research into who's supporting the candidates that they're voting for.
If you just joined us, I'm talking with Eli Pales and Ian Hawley. They're student reporters from Michigan State University who are part of the Capital Expenditure Project. Let's talk broadly. What did you do in this project, Eli?
Yeah, so we began by, we worked with the Michigan Campaign Finance Network to get the records of all the legislators in Michigan, their campaign finance reports for the last year. We then divvied that up. There's seven of us in our groups, and we split it up about 21 legislators for each person to go through and find the number of PAC contributions, to find the total number of contributions to each legislator for 2017. Then we each took turns verifying each other's data to make sure that we scrapped the data correctly. And then from there, we started doing calculations. We looked at numbers, started asking questions, you know, why is it that this number turned out this way? Are there any differences we can see between gender? Are there any differences we can see between party? And each person took a story that they were interested in and kind of ran with it. And they're like, well, we have these numbers, and now we want to know why they turned out that way. We called a lot of experts. We called a lot of legislators to try to get those answers. And that's ultimately what came into our report.
Ian, what were the biggest challenges the group faced in doing all this reporting?
So one of the biggest challenges we faced is trying to portray ourselves in a professional manner to where we could get the kind of responses that we wanted from the people we were contacting. So for example, when I reached out to a lot of the legislators on my short list that I had of people who raised the least amount of money through PAC contributions, I had a hard time getting in touch with some of those people just because, you know, we're from the Spartan newsroom, and it's not a, you know, the big recognizable name like the New York Times or even something like the Lansing State Journal here in Lansing. So I had a hard time getting to people and making them think that this wasn't just another homework assignment that I was doing, you know, that this was actually going to be published and available for people to read. So I think that was the biggest challenge that I myself faced, and I have a feeling that my group members would say the same if they were here.
Eli, overall, how easy was it for the group to get the information you were all looking for?
So the information actually itself was pretty easy to get a hold of. It was just pretty tedious. You have to go on the Secretary of State's pretty outdated website. You know, Michigan's infrastructure is not that great on when it comes to roads, and it's not that great when it comes to online either. So it took time for us to gather the results individually, for us to get those in spreadsheets, for us to actually do the data crunching we needed. So it wasn't necessarily that challenging. Anyone could do it. It just took us a long time. And then to do our double checks to verify everyone had the correct data. The hardest part, as Ian said, I would say, is actually getting responses from people. And legislators weren't responding for a myriad of reasons. Maybe they just didn't want to talk to us because they might be ashamed of the money they took. Maybe they didn't take us seriously, as Ian said. But that was definitely a challenge where we reached out collectively to probably nearly 50 legislators and only heard back from a few.
Interesting. So there are questions you had that you weren't able to get answered.
Yeah, and, you know, the answers that we did get from the people we did reach really varied, and so it would have really been nice to get a more broad perspective on that.
I know you kind of cut this data seven ways to Sunday looking at breaking it down, but I'm particularly interested, guys, if you noticed any differences between Republicans and Democrats when it came to campaign finance. What did you find, Eli?
Yeah, we looked at the average amount raised by Democrats and Republicans and then the average that came from PACs. What we found is that Republicans raised more on average, but as a percentage of the amount they raised, Democrats took more PAC money, which was definitely interesting, kind of overrode my priors. I thought that I would kind of be the other way around. But they still took a comparable amount of PAC money each. It's just that the Republicans raised more money overall, and because of that, a smaller percentage came from PACs.
Ian, it's tough to get a lot of people interested or worked up about campaign finance issues. I think people can easily dismiss it with kind of some version of, well, they're politicians, of course they take money, what's new? Why should people care about this?
Well, it's interesting. I asked someone the same question. He was actually a former campaign finance manager. And he said, to be quite honest with you, if I was running in the election, I would take all the PAC money I could. I would take all the corporate sponsorships that I could, because no one really pays attention to the local elections, especially not in the primaries. So I think if more people took the time to do some research, to sit down by themselves and actually figure out what these candidates are talking about and what their platforms really are, and then went out and participated in the primaries and the general elections at the city and state level, then people would be a lot more clear on what was going to happen in the next term. And they would be probably more happy with the way things went if they got out and participated in these elections. It's pretty easy to sit back and say, oh, our governor or oh, our mayor is messing things up for us. But you can't really say that kind of thing if you don't go out and participate in these elections. You know, as we saw with the 2016 presidential election, a lot of people didn't go out and vote in that. Now you see a lot of people unhappy with the results. So I think people should care about this kind of thing because it makes it a lot more clear as to where these candidates' money is coming from, and people can make a more informed decision on who they're going to vote for if they pay attention to things like campaign finances.
Eli, anything you want to add?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think one of the big things is that it is an issue that can be counteracted, but it takes a kind of collective problem solving. You know, money can only go so far, and if everyone fully investigated every candidate on the ballot, then in the end, money really wouldn't play much of a factor. But if you talk to the candidates, they say that they need money to get their message out because voters are not necessarily seeking that information themselves. They're kind of waiting for the information to come to them. And so when you talk to some of them, that's why it's so expensive. You know, Senator Curtis Sertel is someone we talked to who really wants reform in the system and, you know, is very dismayed at how expensive it is. He says, you know, well, it costs $20,000 to send just one mailer to my district. And, you know, if people aren't seeking that information out themselves, then the candidates are going to try to get that information out. I mean, that's when really the costs start rising.
Eli Pales, Ian Hawley, student reporters from Michigan State University who took part in the Capital Expenditure Project. Great talking with you, and thank you so much for sharing your work with us.
Thanks for having us again.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It was great.
I hope you will join all of us when Stateside goes on the road. We're going to be doing a show in Grand Rapids. We'll be at the Celebration Cinema North Thursday evening, May 3rd. That is 1 week from tonight. and we'd love to have you there in the audience. Register to attend and find out all the details. Just go to the Stateside page at michiganradio.org. Still to come, a new report looks at the constitutional right to counsel in Wayne County and the effects of underfunding.
Attorneys that have 20 years at the bar who are handling serious felony cases making $35,000, it's really unheard of in this country.
Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. You have the right to an attorney. If you can't afford an attorney, one will be appointed for you. It's a phrase most of us know from the Miranda rights that police officers are required to read off when someone's arrested, part of the Sixth Amendment to our Constitution. But a study released today shows that in Wayne County, if you can't afford an attorney, your options are likely to be constitutionally inadequate. With us now is one of the authors of that report. David Carroll is executive director of the Sixth Amendment Center. It's a nonpartisan, nonprofit organization in Boston. David Carroll, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
First, let's get everybody on the same page. Remind people what the Constitution actually guarantees when it comes to the Sixth Amendment.
Well, it's not just a person with a bar card standing next to you, but it's actually an attorney with the time and resources to do an effective job on your behalf.
So when we talk about the right to have an attorney, you're saying an effective person standing right there with you.
Exactly. At every critical stage of a criminal or delinquency process.
So your report looks specifically at what's called the SDO, the State Defender Office. This office handles 25% of Wayne County's indigent felony cases. So what were you tasked to examine?
We were asked to specifically look at that office. With the new Michigan standards coming into play, there is some question whether this, basically a nonprofit law firm, should be expanded to take more cases or looking at various ways to see if they were being effective and efficient with the taxpayers' money.
The office has 16 attorneys. What did you discover about their working conditions?
That's pretty much all they have. Most public defender offices not only have attorneys, but have a wide range of support staff. So, for instance, you don't want to be paying an attorney to be standing making photocopies. There's certain template files that could be done by a paralegal. If you're looking to get a client bed space, if they have issues with mental health or drug addiction, social workers are better skilled at that. And of course, you want to have professional investigators going out and doing a lot of the work at crime scenes and others. In the SDO office in Wayne County, they basically have 16 attorneys and that's it. They have some data clerks, but they have none of the full range of support staff that most public defender offices have in this country.
So 16 attorneys, no investigators, no paralegals, no social workers. What about caseloads? How many felony cases do they get in a year?
This is sometimes hard for lay people to understand, but when you get a case, all the work that you have to do on that, there is a number at which you can't be effective anymore if you're doing it. National standards have been set since the early 70s, and most people believe those standards are outdated now, that they should be much, much lower than that. These 16 attorneys were handling far in excess of what those caseloads were. So those standards say an attorney should handle no more than 150 cases a year. Think about that, 150 felony cases. That's opening and closing one about every 2 days. That is too high a standard, and the SDO attorneys were in far excess of that number.
How many felony cases are these attorneys, these 16 attorneys in Wayne County, handling?
They're handling over 200 felony cases a year. On average, it's 217, which is about 145% of the national average.
So here we have these 16 attorneys working with caseloads at 145% of the national standards with no support staff, and they've got an annual average salary of $35,000. How does this compare with other big cities?
Well, it's the lowest salary that I've seen for a major metropolitan area, and I've been doing indigent defense assessments for over 20 years. So it may be that there's some pockets in our country where if it's a lawyer fresh out of law school, their first job, they may be getting something in that range. But we're talking about attorneys that have 20 years at the bar who are handling serious felony cases, including murders, making $35,000. It's really unheard of in this country.
In your report, you compared what Wayne County prosecutors make versus these SDO attorneys. And according to your report, the lowest level prosecutors make about $51,000 a year. Lead attorneys, the highest level, make up to $123,000 a year. That seems to be quite an imbalance in compensation between public prosecutors and public defenders. Is that normal?
Unfortunately, in this country, there is disparity between prosecution and defense. This level of disparity is not the norm. You may have a public defender making 10% less than their analogous person in the prosecutor's office. But this sort of wide disparity is not the norm in this country. And in fact, when we were there, there was a young attorney that hadn't been with the state defender office very long, who, you know, by all accounts was a very strong lawyer. Well, the Wayne County prosecutor hired him while we were there doing our assessment. And he said, look, you know, they're moving me up to 50-something thousand a year. I got student loans to pay and other things like that. So it really is a cause for sort of a talent loss going on in the Wayne County Public Defender.
Your report also looked at the funding for the SDO office, the State Defender Office, over time. What'd you find there?
This was pretty incredulous to me, is that for a 16-year period, they never got an increase, not even a penny, for more resources. And over that time period, you had the cost of representation increasing, so overhead costs like legal research and keeping the lights on and other things like that. And 25% of the caseload doesn't mean that you've locked the same number of cases. As the caseload of the whole county grows, 25% is a larger number of cases. And so the basic conclusion is over this 16-year period, they were asked to do more and more with less and less.
What surprised you most about your findings?
I think it was that an office could be devolving in a major metropolitan area. Now, there are indigent defense issues all across this country, and people aren't being properly represented. But to actually have an office going in the other direction, getting less and less money to provide representation, is something that really floored me, especially in Michigan, because there's been such attention on the indigent defense issue, whether it was through Governor Snyder's advisory group that led to the Michigan Indigent Defense Commission legislation, to the ACLU lawsuit. Over and over again, there was ample opportunity for Wayne County to take a look at what was going on and saying, we need to do better.
Frame this for us, if you would, David Carroll. Just how bad is Wayne County compared to other populous urban counties in the country?
I mean, it's for me, it was very eye-opening. I think it was among the most efficient systems I've ever seen in my 20-year career.
You've gotten some pushback from many of the people you interviewed. They pointed to the SDO's trial rate as proof that the office provides effective representation. The trial rate over 8% in 2017, and you found every defense attorney had won as many or more trials than they lost in the past 2 years. That doesn't sound too bad. So what's wrong with that picture?
Well, first of all, I do want to say that I think there are good lawyers in the office and in the system. This isn't about the people themselves. It's about the system they're forced to work in. And so the problem is that when you look at a trial rate like that and you think instinctively that that's good, the problem is that it's a triage system. To be able to focus on three or four cases that go to trial a year, in a system where you're 145% over the national caseload average, you're basically writing off a bunch of other cases just so you can focus on those. So the right to counsel is not the right to get it majority right. The right to counsel is a right to each and every individual defendant. It's their right. And so if you get it kind of right, that you're not doing your job. And so just pointing to those trial rates and the number of not guilty verdicts doesn't get at the heart of what's going on in Wayne County.
Besides the clear picture you've painted that the SDO attorneys just don't have the time to provide effective representation, I thought it was pretty jaw-dropping your finding that these 16 SDO attorneys have to be in 29 different courtrooms on Monday through Thursday and in 30 different courtrooms on Friday for almost the entire time these courts are in session. So what's the ultimate result of that?
Well, what they end up doing is they start substituting in and out for each other's cases. You know, oh, I need to be in these two courtrooms. Can you cover this one for me? Can you cover that one? What that ends up doing is the defendants feel like they're on an assembly line, that they don't have a real attorney, that someone's jumping in and appearing at this hearing, but the next hearing it's something else, and they may or may not have read the case file. And so they can't properly advocate for the defendant in that type of system. I'll tell you one sort of anecdote. My first day there, I sent the team and said, why don't you start doing some court observations? I'm going to go over to the office and start learning what I can about the operations there. Well, I was at the office at 8:30 in the morning, and I didn't see an attorney in the office till about 2 in the afternoon. And then it was only one or two, because they were constantly trying to fill the court processes that they needed to be doing, which leads very little time to be doing investigation or even simply just keeping the defendants up to date of what's going on in their case. Again, another issue without having support staff there.
David Carroll, in your view, how far has Wayne County strayed from constitutional requirements to provide lawyers for criminal defendants?
Well, you know, I've heard this said before about Michigan. I think it's very true for Wayne County. It's not just that they weren't meeting the constitutional obligation. It was they were, in fact, sailing away from what they were supposed to be doing. I'm quite pleased that the state and county appear to be stepping up to the plate to rectify these issues, but that's basically just turning the boat around. They have a long way to go to get back to where they should be, let alone the expansion of the right to counsel that certainly is going to happen in future years.
Your report lists some recommendations. Where should Wayne County start?
We put in our report that for a public defender office to handle 25% of the cases in Wayne County, they would essentially need to triple their budget, move to more than 30 attorneys and the requisite social workers, paralegals, and investigators. Wayne County put in a grant for that, and it was approved by the Michigan Indigent Defense Commission. They still need to have the legislature appropriate that money, but, you know, my hat's off to both the state and the county for stepping up and trying to rectify this. They are also got a grant that is going to allow them to hire a local consultant who's going to help them figure out and reimagine how these services could be best done given the new money at the state level.
This report looked at 25%. What about the other 75% of Wayne County's indigent cases?
So the other 75% are handled by private attorneys who are paid a set rate for handling those cases. There's been some question during our report about whether that system is healthy or not. And so part of this new grant is for us to come back to Wayne County and assess the other 75%. So again, hats off to Wayne County and the Michigan Indigent Defense Commission for wanting to know the answer to that very question and putting the money up for us to do another study.
David Carroll is executive director of the Sixth Amendment Center. It's a nonpartisan, nonprofit organization in Boston that studied and did an evaluation of the state defender office looking at the right to counsel in Wayne County. David, thank you so much for talking with us on Stateside.
My pleasure. Thanks for highlighting the issue.
With us now to get Wayne County's response to this report is Dawn Van Hoek. She's the former state appellate defender. Now she is the lead public defense consultant for Wayne County. Dawn, pleasure to welcome you.
Thank you. Really a pleasure to be here.
So you've been brought in on a grant to do what exactly with this report?
Right. I am working with Wayne County stakeholders, primarily the county and the court, to develop the most effective and best possible public defense system for Wayne County.
Well, the county has secured a nearly $18 million grant from the Michigan Indigent Defense Commission. Help us understand, what will that money be used for?
That money is intended to help the county to comply with the first standards that the MIDC approved, the first four standards.
And tell us those, just so we are all on the same page.
Yes. Okay. So these are standards that have been adopted primarily by the American Bar Association years ago, and they are the elements of an effective public defense system. So the first four were very straightforward, and I think probably the easiest of the collection. Training, adequate training for lawyers, interviews with clients that are timely and effective, providing counsel at the first appearance in court when bail decisions are made, and then access to investigators and experts for defense counsel.
Okay. Thinking of the report that came out today about the way things have been in Wayne County, you have 16 attorneys, $35,000 salary, zero support staff. What's it going to take? Is that your remit, is to get that fixed?
Absolutely.
And how quickly?
I think that we can probably see improvements in a public defender agency as part of the mixed system within the year that I'm going to be on the ground. I'm really hopeful.
You say changes, do you see more attorneys coming to, because the caseload now is astounding compared to the national average?
Yes, absolutely. And that is what the grant from the state of Michigan is intended to provide.
Okay.
So it's part of this compliance plan, and it's the first piece. So it's very attainable. We had great experts on the ground. He had a nationwide group of really, really excellent people who were helping us with the not only what's wrong, but
what do
planning
we do
for the future? How do we handle this? How many attorneys would be a reasonable number?
And he did break those down for us, and he talked about money, and he talked about more support staff, all those recommendations. And it does sound optimistic. The changes are coming. But for those people who were assigned an attorney with the State Defender Office in the last 15 years, people who might still be in prison or have a felony conviction on their record, what do you say to them and their family members? I mean, of course, it doesn't mean everyone was innocent, but I have to imagine after hearing this report, they have got to be some who will feel that their fates could have been different if they had an attorney with the basic resources, as is their constitutional right. How do you respond to those frustrations?
That is an incredibly frustrating situation. Now, I've been an appellate lawyer for my entire career, and for 42 years, in fact. And I would say that anyone who feels strongly that an injustice was done in their case, they should pursue appellate remedies. And this can be done on a case-by-case basis. That's about it, though. I mean, there are going to be a lot of people who are going to remain very frustrated about what happened to them in the past.
So you see your mission is to change this narrative as quickly as possible.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We've done a lot of studying already. I think it's time to take action and do something very positive. I'm tremendously excited about the opportunity that these reports present for us. And it's really only possible now because the state of Michigan is poised to step up and provide the funding that we need.
But is that money assured?
Absolutely not. There's an appropriations process in our state, and every year the MIDC will be appearing in front of the legislature and the appropriations committees to ask for money to make the state of Michigan and its counties compliant with the Constitution. So the state is in a position to step up and put some money behind all of this. Because no matter how many good intentions we all have and how much planning we do, it's not going to amount to anything if we don't have that additional money put on the table.
Dawn Van Hoek is the lead public defense consultant for Wayne County. Dawn, thank you so much for speaking with us.
My pleasure.
Today's Stateside was directed by Ellie Billings and engineered by Peg Watson. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mike Blank, Joey Horan, Sarah Leeson, Mercedes Mejia, and Lindsay Scullin. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.